First of all, I'd like to thank you all very much for allowing me to visit your wonderful community. First time as a preacher. I have been here a few times before, but only I think twice. Once, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, once 25 years ago. So, and of course, I'd like to ask for the blessings of the senior devotees here to help me to offer some little service here to all of you. So, usually when I visit a community the first time, I do like to introduce myself a little bit, because naturally people are wondering, who is this person here, you know? So, as you know, my name is Sabaki Devidasi. I am actually German, but I left Germany already 30 years ago, in 85. I used to work as a physiotherapist in Heimutra, and I could immediately feel that with my treatments I cannot give people real happiness. And therefore I came to a point where I was so frustrated and simply empty within the heart there. Even though materially it was a fantastic job. My schedule was 6 months working, 6 months traveling, and then coming back to your own old work, so it was very good. But I just felt, no, this is not what I'm meant to do. And I was pretty radical. I sold everything, I gave everything away, and I could strongly feel I probably will never come back to Germany, and even if I come back, I will not need all these things anymore. So I simply packed the backpack and started traveling, searching for the medicine that would give real happiness. And I traveled quite a lot around Europe, around Africa, around Australia. And then finally, after a long search and many adventures, I met the devotees in Sydney. That was in 85. And within a few days, I realized that's it. And I moved into the Brahmacharini Ashram. And, well, since then, I never left the Association of Devotees, so it was simply a question of a few days. And, boom, I felt I had finally come home. So, and then I spent 4 years in the Brahmacharini Ashram in Sydney and got the training, you know, all the basic things of the devotional life. And in those days, I took initiation of Bhavananda. He was the zonal acharya there at that time. Things were a little different then.
You're next year.
Hi?
You're next year. For the stroke reason, huh?
So, and then I was married for 10 years. So I actually went quite nicely to all the ashrams. I was married for 10 years. And my former husband, his parents came from Latvia, from the Baltics. So 2 months after we got married, we ventured all the way to Latvia and started preaching there. That was in 89. It was just when the communist system fell apart. And we were not even conscious, really, of what an adventure we were getting into. By Krishna's arrangement, we kind of organized the first more systematic temple in the former Soviet Union, actually. So many devotees heard, oh, there are some devotees from Australia there, and they all came. So we had about 75 brahmacharis and 30 brahmacharinis. Wow, it was full. It was really ecstatic. I was like the mother of the whole setup there. And yeah, we had very adventurous times in pioneer work. We really started from nothing. No saris, no spices, no deities, no building, nothing. And somehow by Krishna's mercy everything manifested. And I did learn a lot in those days, as you may imagine. So then, yes, at that time we also took reinitiation of Prabhu Vishnu in those days, Swami Prabhu. And then in 99, my husband decided to take a break from Krishna consciousness, as these things sometimes happen. He married a non-devotee and went different ways, and even today he's not practicing anything. So, and of course, these things are always a shame and somewhat painful, but nevertheless, I also took it as Krishna's mercy. And I thought, all right, let me move on now. Enough of this man-woman business. And, yeah, I was 40 at the time, so it was relatively early, but it actually felt extremely natural for me. So I did not always look like this. I had silk saris and bangles and earrings and nose rings and whatever not. So I went through it all. But then I just felt enough, no need. You know. So, and since 99, for the last 15 years, I've been living the life of a traveling preacher, basically out of a suitcase. And I have a very nice schedule. I spend So my schedule is basically 6 months in Bangladesh, India, and Nepal, mainly Bangladesh actually. And then when it gets too hot there at the end of April, then I'm coming back to Europe. And in Europe, I have been mainly spending my time in Ukraine, but also a few surrounding countries, Moldova, Sweden. Now, only the last 3 years I've been starting to go to Germany as a preacher. I've always made a big circle around Germany for some reason. But now I'm also spending some time there. Yeah, so this is so much about my humble self. I do have two main very strong convictions in my preaching efforts. I think we all have to have some strong convictions, otherwise life can become boring. So my first conviction is that we need to make a stronger effort to get on deeper levels of chanting in japa as well as in kirtan. I'm very strongly convinced of this, that we easily take this very lightly and superficial, and we just walk around blabbering something there while we're doing so many other things. And this is actually not chanting, we're doing something else there. And because I have this strong conviction, I've started conducting holy name retreats inspired by His Holiness Satchitananda Swami. I actually attended one retreat here some 4 or 5 years ago, and this really convinced me of the need of holding retreats like this. So in all the countries where I'm visiting, Ukraine and Sweden and Nepal, Bangladesh, also Ikachakra, I've started conducting holy name retreats, and it's quite a deep experience actually. At least 50% comes from just leaving behind all one's usual distractions, because we don't even realize how much we are distracted with so many things. And just going in seclusion and leaving everything behind for 3 or 4 days really gives them such a deeper focus, and according to how much we absorb ourselves, we can actually enter a different reality. That's quite amazing. So this is one of my strong convictions, and then the other one is the need to understand more deeply spiritual culture. Yes, because having spent, you know, a considerable time, 2 or 3 months every year for the last 15 years in Bangladesh, I have received some little insights into the importance. importance of spiritual culture. And just for you to understand, Bangladesh is a very unique place. It's almost like a different planet. It's actually East Bengal. So all, most of Mahaprabhu's eternal associates come from that part. Like Rupa and Sanatana Goswami and Vaishnava Acharya, Pundarik Vidyanidhi, Narottam Das Thakur. Oh, there's so many, even his parents, Jagannath Mishra, Sachimata, they all come from that part of Bengal. He's on the border. Yeah. Haridaspur is actually the border town. He kind of is just in between there. And the main thing is, today, this is Bangladesh, this is a Muslim country, and this is completely a divine arrangement. Because this is what preserves the culture. Wow. Because the Muslims, as we know, they're not much in favor of all the American nonsense, if I may say so. Yeah, they really are very traditional, and that has preserved the culture immensely. It's amazing. It's really like entering Chaitanya Charitamrita when you travel there. It's really amazing. The whole bhajan, kirtan, prasadam culture, it's all going on amazingly. Yes. Yes, I mean, this is such an amazing place. You know, there's even, just to give you an idea, you can visit there Mother Vendrapuri's original bhajan kutia, the original one. You know, so Mother Vendrapuri, that's Ishwar Puri's spiritual master, that's two generations before Mahaprabhu, original, not renovated. You can feel all the rocks and stones still carry some special energy there, you know. It's not all covered with bathroom tiles or something like they do in India, you know. They renovate in the name of progress and it's all covered with bright blue tiles or something. No, it's all the original stones and rocks there, you know. Amazing. And it's completely in the jungle. There's even no rope going there. You have to go on the back of a motorbike there. Through the rice fields on tiny little tracks there. I mean, it's really amazing. Such jewels, such treasures you can discover there. Same Jagannath Mishra's residency, it's still there. The original one. Of course, it's falling apart. But it's untouched because they simply don't even have any money to renovate it. And this is also not bad. So you can walk up the same, exactly the same steps where Jagannath Mishra was walking up. Amazing. Yeah. And all the devotees, well, they're also, well, let's not generalize, not all the devotees, but many devotees you can see, they are special souls. There's some reason why they took birth there at the same places where, you know, Rupa and Sanatana Goswami appeared and all this. And because it is so isolated also amongst the devotees, you know, the mood is just so different. It's just, wow, even sometimes when Brahmacharis from Mayapur are coming to Bangladesh, they are amazed. They say, wow, we didn't know that all this is going on here. You know, they're really blown out. That's Bengali Brahmacharis from Mayapur. You know, even for them, it is a different planet. You know, sometimes when our boys go to India, I ask them, so how was your India trip? And they said, yes. They say, it's all right, but I wouldn't want to live there. Too Western. Don't like the mentality there in India. That's their mood. You know, it is. Anyway, so because I've spent so much time there, and when I'm there, I'm only with the locals. There's practically no Western devotees there because it is a little austere. Now it is getting a little bit more, you know, set up. But 15 years ago when I was there, first time, no temple had a proper bathroom. I had to take baths in the yard on the pump, you know, through the Punjabi suit. And the whole village came and watched, you know, trying to witness how this Western prisoner is taking baths, you know. This was instead of a TV program, totally. So it takes a little time to get used to it, to adjust. But now the temples are more set up and everything. But in any case, I only work with the locals, live with them, eat with them, travel with them, preach with them. And this is the opportunity to get deeper insights into spiritual culture. Because that's the place to learn it and to experience it. And again, I've learned so much in these 15 years there. In fact, gradually I received a whole transformation of the consciousness and of the tastes and attachments and behavior patterns and desires and so on. And this is actually what Krishna consciousness is meant to bring about. You know, we want to actually deeply, internally transform ourselves. We don't want to keep everything as it is, maintain all our old ways, but we want to transform. And if that doesn't happen, we can actually say our spiritual life is somewhat a little external and superficial. Yeah. So, and I guess this is where culture comes in. Culture immensely helps to make this deeper transformation. Yes. And another interesting thing is, spiritual culture is any culture where God consciousness is the center. Of course, the very origin of any spiritual culture is Vedic culture. Because as we know, Parikshit Maharaj and Yudhishthira Maharaj, they were ruling the whole planet. So in those days, the whole planet had that culture. And then as things were splitting up into all different countries and languages, and also the religions were splitting up, the Sanatana Dharma was splitting up in all the different religions, and they again were locally developing in a different way. But nevertheless, and I mean, I've just done a little tour in Germany, at least in Germany, I don't know how it is in Belgium, but in Germany you do have strong, you know, just 80-100 years ago, there was a strong spiritual culture there. And you see the leftovers. Every little village has a beautiful old church in the middle of it. And there's so many monasteries which now have been transformed into, you know, concert halls or conference centers or something. But it's all still there. You can smell it type thing. You can detect it, you know. It's all still there. So, and any spiritual culture where God is the center, we can extract universal principles. They have the same universal principles. And, this is my strong conviction, unless we preach them, and we recognize them, and we preserve them, very easily they get lost in the name of reformation. has happened, for example, in Christianity. They did not recognize these universal principles. Often we have this tendency, we get lost in the details and we forget the principles. And they did not recognize and preserve the principles. And that's why in due course, in the name of reforming and modernizing, all lost. And I am convinced that we are running the danger that this happens also in Rotterdam, I think it's time to move on. Yes, unless we recognize the universal principles of spiritual culture, not Indian culture or Bengali culture. No, this is a misunderstanding. It's got nothing to do with Indian or Bengali. Simply today, India, Bengal, you will find more spiritual culture there. But it doesn't mean we all have to become Bengalis now or something. No. This is bodily concept, actually, if we understand in those terms. No, but even Christianity, even Muslim, you can find, if you look deeper, you can actually find the same principles. Just, they might apply it a little differently, like the Muslims have the tendency to just overdo it a little bit. And just slightly always get it wrong at their application. But the principles are there, and they're the same. So, yes, these are very intriguing and interesting topics, and because I feel I have learned so much there, that's why I have put courses together. The overall topic is exploring the roots of spiritual culture, and then there is women in spiritual culture, there is men in spiritual culture, there's family life in spiritual culture. There's children in spiritual culture. There's the elders in spiritual culture. Yeah, so it's so many things we can learn there and simply extract the principles. Because after all, spiritual culture is Krishna's culture and it is applicable everywhere in this world. In the same way like chanting Hare Krishna works everywhere. It's not an Indian thing or something. Many people also think that outside there. Yeah, so that's the thing that's kind of almost an impossible mission, I sometimes feel. Because this whole current of materialism and materialistic culture is so strong, you really have to swim against it, So, but anyway, I am simply keeping myself busy with this. These courses I'm teaching in Mayapur every year, you even got a poster on your notice board there of the schedule in Mayapur in January. So now you meet the person behind this. And yes, and also in Ukraine I'm teaching these courses every year. And in Gomukadam, which is not really far, and wherever communities invite me. So now it so happened that I'm here to teach this course for the ladies, women in spiritual culture, And it is very systematic. With materials, you get handouts for every lesson, you get even essays, and depending on what the mood is, I usually do role plays, which really deepens the learning experience and makes the whole thing into a very sweet and more interactive experience. So I'm simply hoping that some ladies from this community will have the time over 5 days, 3 to 6 every afternoon, to take part. Okay. So also I forgot to mention just a couple of years ago, one more time, I took reinitiation of Nirantana Swami, third time around. Like in German, we say, alle guten Dinge sind drei. You understand this? All good things you have to do three times, don't But just as a little side comment, I can tell you frankly, all these three personalities were the perfect guru at the perfect time for me. Yes. Krishna sends the right person at the right time to bring us further. So it worked out perfectly for me. Yes. And if we understand things, if we understand Kutapa a little more deeper, we realize it's not limited just to one person. You know? Of course, ideally, Guru should not fall away and all that, no doubt. But nevertheless, there's no loss. No loss. And once we understand things deeply, we can again aspire to fully surrender. Doesn't matter how often this happens. Because this principle of full surrender is also an eternal principle while we're here in the material world. We have to have that full surrender. You know, that's how we practice to fully surrender to Guru, to Krishna. So if we want to get back to this spiritual world, we have to have that mood of full surrender. Doesn't matter how often the Guru falls away. It's an eternal principle. In the same way as it is an eternal principle that we have Guru while we're here in the material world. Sometimes he's only internally there as Chaitya Guru, and then sometimes he's externally manifest as Diksha, Shiksha, Vajra, Dasha Guru, or whatever. So we have to understand things more deeply, you know, and then we will not lose faith just because some accidents are happening there on the world road. Yeah. Okay, so now let us move on to the Bhagavatam. I'm sorry, but Manohar Prabhu requested me to introduce the seminar a little bit combined into the Bhagavatam class, so this is what I'm trying to do. Okay. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we are starting a new chapter in the sixth canto, chapter 11. So shall I read this introduction? Do you usually read this?
You do weekly introductions.
You do. So I will read it. So the chapter is called The Transcendental Qualities of Vritrasura. This chapter describes Vritrasura's great qualities. When the prominent commanders of the demons fled, not hearing Vritrasura's advice, Vritrasura condemned them all as cowards. Speaking very bravely, he stood alone to face the demigods. When the demigods saw Vritrasura's attitude, they were so afraid that they practically fainted, and Vritrasura began trampling them down. Unable to tolerate this, Indra, the king of the demigods, threw his club at Vritrasura. But Vritrasura was such a great hero. That he easily caught the club with his left hand and used it to beat Indra's elephant. Struck by the blow of Vritrasura, the elephant was pushed back 14 yards and fell with Indra on its back. King Indra had first accepted Vishwarup as his priest and thereafter killed him. Reminding Indra of his heinous activities, Vritrasura said, "If one is a devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu, and depends on Lord Vishnu in every respect, then victory, opulence, and peace of mind are all inevitably available. Such a person has nothing for which to aspire in the three worlds. The Supreme Lord is so kind that he especially favors such a devotee by not giving him opulence that will hamper his devotional service. Therefore, I wish to give up everything for the service of the Lord. I wish always to chant the glories of the Lord and engage in his service. Let me become unattached to my worldly family and make friendships with the devotees of the Lord. I do not desire to be promoted to the higher planetary systems, even to Dhruvaloka or Brahmaloka, nor do I desire an unconquerable position within this material world. I have no need for such things. So, since the first three verses are without purport, we are chanting the fourth one on the board there. So, what I'll do is I'll just read the translations. So, verse number one. Sri Sukadeva Goswami said, O King, Vijrasura, the commander in chief of the demons, advised his lieutenants, lieutenants, in the principles of religion, but the cowardly demoniac commanders, intent upon fleeing the battlefield, were so disturbed by fear that they could not accept his words. So then text 2 and 3. O King Parikshit, the demigods, taking advantage of a favorable opportunity presented by time, attacked the army of the demons from the rear and began driving away the demoniac soldiers, scattering them here and there as if their army had no leader. Seeing the pitiable condition of his soldiers, Vijrasura, the best of the Asuras, who was called Indrasatru, the enemy of Indra, was very much aggrieved. Unable to tolerate such reverses, he stopped and forcefully rebuked the demigod, speaking the following words in an angry mood. Such killing is never glorious, nor can it promote one to the heavenly planets. Vichasura rebuked both the demigods and the demoniac soldiers because the demons were running in fear of their lives and the demigods were killing them from behind. The actions of both were abominable. When a fight takes place, the opposing parties must be prepared to fight like heroes. A hero never runs from the battlefield, from the field of battle. He always fights face to face, determined to gain victory or lay down his life in the fight. That is heroic. Killing an enemy from behind is also inglorious. When an enemy turns his back and runs in fear of his life, he should not be killed. This is the etiquette of military science. Vichasura insulted the demoniac soldiers by comparing them to the stool of their mothers. Both stool and the cowardly son come from the abdomen of the mother, and Vichasura said that there is no difference between them. A similar comparison was given by Tulsidas, who commented that a son and urine both come from the same channel. In other words, semen and urine both come from the genitals, but semen produces a child, whereas urine produces nothing. Therefore, if a child is neither a hero nor a devotee, he is not a son, but urine. Similarly, Chanakya Pandit also says, Kota putena jatena yunadi vangadamika kanena chakshusha kimba chakshu padaiva kela. What is the use of a son who is neither glorious nor devoted to the Lord? Such a son is like a blind eye, which simply gives pain but cannot help one see. Sorry, he's trying to put it, just expressing it a little bit milder. not compared to stool or urine or whatever. At least only a blind eye, which causes pain, and is also useless, after all. Yes, so we've got a few minutes to just briefly comment on a few little topics here. Mm-hmm. First of all, this chapter is indeed a very wonderful chapter which describes this glorious battle between Vichasura and Indra. As we all know, of course, Vichasura is a devotee just in a demon's body. And he knows exactly, actually, that he will be killed in this battle. But it is his duty to fight. And therefore, in a very joyful and happy mood, he is doing his duty, even to the extent of preaching to Indra, don't feel intimidated there when he drops his weapon. Just pick it up, fight. So he really preaches to him because he knows, Vichasura knows, after this battle, he will go back to God. And it is actually a very wonderful example of how a devotee should meet death. Death is actually also one of my favorite topics. I've got a whole seminar on death. And I'm using Vichasura there as an example. Because this is really how a devotee should face death. With conviction, with joy, with hope, yes. This is going to be the chance for me to get on the plane off to Goloka Vrindavan. So there is actually no need to, by hook or by crook, wanting to stay here and I would not know, and where can I find a healer who I can, you know, be healed by? Of course, the body is given to us by Krishna, it's our duty to maintain it and use it in his service, but when the time comes, you know, we should be following in Richard Sewer's footsteps. And of course, this is only possible, it is all a question of relationship with the Lord. Yes. If there is a relationship, if we actually have endeavored to establish a relationship with the Lord, then we will lose our fear of death. Yeah. Then it will be very natural. Yes, the Lord has been waiting for me for many, many lifetimes. So why delaying? Let's just go. It's all a question of relationship. If the relationship is there, it will be most natural. But if there is no relationship, then we will be clinging on to the temporary relationships in our life. And then those relationships will be the main relationships for us. And then we will not want to go. We will not want. Yeah. Very natural. So it's all a question of relationship. I mean, we have that experience in our life, as a traveling preacher, I know this, when you go to a yatra where you don't know anybody, you know, then you feel, you know, you're not sure, do I really want to go there? But if you know, oh, there's Vishaka Mataji and there's Anandini Mataji, then, and Kanchana Valli Mataji, then of course, yes, there's relationships, let's go. You know, so the same thing is there with the spiritual world. If we have not managed to actually establish a relationship with Krishna, then we will be afraid. And of course, the way to establish the relationship is nothing else but chanting. That's when we connect with the Lord. That's the purpose, establishing the relationship. Nothing else. And of course, we only do that when we really mindfully turn to the Lord when we chant. Otherwise, we are not associating with the Lord. And then the relationship will never develop. In fact, we can spend many, many lifetimes with so-called chanting and so-called devotional service, but leaving Krishna completely out of the picture. This is possible. Yeah. One can keep oneself so busy with my plans and programs and this and that, but where is my relationship with Krishna? Yeah. Yeah. It's indeed possible. Completely neglecting and forgetting that. Yeah. And then, of course, we will be afraid of death. But if we have made an effort in chanting and really turning towards Krishna, then the relationship will develop tangibly. It will become a tangible reality. And then, and proportionally, our fear of death will diminish. So our fear of death is almost like, an indication of how much our relationship with Krishna is developed. Of course, not an absolute indication. Some completely ignorant person, you know, who kills himself or something, also might say, I'm not afraid of death or something. So that's, of course, a different story. But as a rule, we can say, you know, the more we develop our relationship, the more our fear will decrease. That's definitely there. It might not be the other way, absolute, that anybody who has no fear of death has a relationship with Krishna out there. It might not quite always work, but the other way it works. The more our relationship is established, the more our fear of death will disappear. So, in any case, yes, Richard Sewer is really the example for devotees to follow how to face death, even then later, when it takes a whole year for this neck to be cut through there. You know, we can compare this to some terminal disease or something, you know, having cancer or something. By the way, I had that transcendental adventure of having been diagnosed with cancer some 7-8 years ago, which was really one of the best experiences in Krishna consciousness I've ever had. And it gave me, wow, a few insights. And it was like a main rehearsal to the final performance. Yes, yes. Oh, it really was an eye-opener. Yes. The main eye-opener for me was that all these things which we consider so important now in our life, when we're facing death, no significance. They are damn unimportant. Yes. The only thing that's really important is my relationship with Krishna. That's the only thing. And that's exactly eternal reality. You know, anything else is kind of part of the nonsensical stage performance, how Prabhupada calls life in the material world. I find this very suitable. Life in the material world is indeed a nonsensical stage performance. We imagine it to be something which we are not, and we're taking it really in and to heart, and we, you know, we're doing our thing, and then at the moment of death, dun 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 dun, curtain closes. You know, the first act is over, and then the next act starts, and you know, so it's quite interesting. So in any case, just a couple more little things. This fight between Vritrasura and Indra, how does that also apply to us? And the thought came to me, we can apply it also as the internal fight we are meant to lead against Anatas, which are nothing else but demons there. Because really, that's what Krishna consciousness is all about. You know, we have to, as I said in the beginning, it is about transformation. And for that, we have to get rid of a few demons there. We have to kill them. And we have to also be victorious, or we have to be a hero in a sense. Very nicely, we can apply these things of how to face battle, you know, that we are not meant to run away and be cowards and flee the battlefield, but we are meant to face the enemy. And this is quite interesting because we are very expert in fleeing the battlefield. And, you know, and sweeping the enemies under the carpet, and not being willing to face them and see them. Yes, and of course it requires, this process of Krishna consciousness is such a deep and internal process. Yeah, very deep. Actually, process of bhakti, it looks very simple. Simply chant and be happy to Krishna. It sounds all really simple. But all these processes, which look externally so simple, internally, they're very deep and very difficult. And actually, because process of bhakti is all about transformation of the heart, is actually the most difficult prophet, actually. Dr. Yamaj is Limapur. He was giving a very wonderful Bhagavatam class, and he was making the statement that when the process of bhakti, most difficult, because we have to transform the heart. And Krishna leaves us the choice. We've got the choice to take it more easy and external and superficial and simply dance and be happy and not be able. Okay, if you want that, you can have it. But for those who want something deeper and something more serious, wow, most difficult. Unless one is really very introspective, really looking within the heart, always watching, what is my motive here? Why am I saying this? Why am I doing this? Always being willing and eager, always endeavoring with great determination. Always endeavoring with great determination. One cannot really make that much progress, I dare to say. The transformation will not take place. It's not something that happens automatically simply by being 30 years in ISKCON or something. No. It requires deep internal work. And for that, we have to face the enemy. We can't run away from the battlefield. And also, I thought, Prabhupada says also, riches who rebuked the demigods because they were killing the demons from behind. So we can also say this also can sometimes happen in our devotional life, that not wanting to criticize anybody or anything, but it can happen innocently that other devotees, can also kill from behind there, trying to get rid of the demon within the devotee, but then actually killing from behind. You can't follow what I'm...
I think I have an idea, but I think it isn't.
Not following the etiquette, actually. That's what it really boils down to. Like Prabhupada here says, when the enemy turns his back and runs in fear of his life, he should not be killed. This is the etiquette of military science. So in the same way, taking care of devotees, one has to be knowledgeable, one has to follow the etiquette, one that cannot allow some very most subtle envy to enter our heart and kind of finish off by mistake the devotee as well, not only the demon or something. Right? It gets a little clearer here from behind.
If you're envious, you might kill the devotee within yourself.
No. If you have a slight trace of envy, and envy is very deep-rooted, very, very subtle, that's why the etiquette is there, strictly speaking. Only a non-envious devotee should be correcting another devotee. You see? Because if the correction comes with non-envy, really being the well-wishing friend, then you can kill the demon, but the devotee will remain, But if there's a slight trace of envy there, then you easily can kill the devotee also. I'm sure we've all been in that situation where we are corrected by somebody, where we can sense a little trace of envy, and, well, it can be, can be not so purifying actually, because it ignites our envy in our heart, Yeah. I'm sure we all know it. We've probably been in most situations many times where we correct somebody and unnoticeably, oh yeah, you shouldn't do this anymore. Yeah. The ego gets in and we try and tell people what to do in order in a subtle way to prove that we are right and we are superior or something. That's what we call envy. And that is not the etiquette in fighting the demons within the heart. And it actually, it brings about the opposite result. You know? It is not nicely accepted. And very easily it ignites our faulty ego. We fight back, we defend, you know. So that's what I mean. You know. Maybe I'm stretching a little bit here, I don't know, but I was contemplating and I thought, well, it is applicable like this, you know. It is. And also that one should be ready to sacrifice one's life in the battle. You know, we have that instruction in one pilgrim Prabhupada says, you know, in regards to guru, one should be willing to lay down one's life in following the orders of guru. So that attitude should be there, this utmost endeavor, never giving up, and basically killing oneself for the sake of transforming, you know, never become complacent or stagnant, but really making that one's life and soul and endeavoring seriously there in order to, yeah, fight the demons where they are. I heard also something about the mother in stool bit there, but I think since we have 5 minutes tonight.
Yeah, save it for next time. We'll have part of it again.
Sorry for next time. Can we ask 5 minutes for questions since 9 o'clock was the utmost deadline? I promise in the future if I ever give again one class, I will not speak so long again. Yeah.
Connected to the topic you just discussed about envy and
her name is Anasuya.
Sorry?
Her name is Anasuya.
Okay.
Not envy.
Okay. Yeah.
So because you mentioned that when seniors or when someone corrects us, that sometimes our own envy can be ignited because there is some envy in the other person. So
yes.
How do we distinguish, or where is the... Because there is also a danger,
yes.
I fear, that we hide behind that, okay, you know, this other person said something, so then I don't need to think.
Yes, that's a very good question. Well, these points are not meant to point the finger at others and judge others, but they are meant to help, you know, transform our own hearts. That's the main essence and aim. So whenever we are in the situation that we are corrected like this with a pinch of envy, we are not meant to say, oh, just see, you know, this will not work, I'm not going to follow that because he didn't correct me in a non-envious way. No, there we are simply meant to look within ourselves and to tolerate and you know, take it as Krishna's mercy to subdue our ego and not get agitated or something. And in the same way, when we correct somebody else, since I have realized this more, I am always very careful with it. You know, when I feel all my ego is pushing me, I have to say, correct this person. I really hold him and say, hang on, let it cool down. Maybe better wait a day, you know, until you cool down and my first corrections don't have to come immediately. It can wait a few hours or a day or two. And so I'm really in a mood of a well-wishing friend. And I even, I even try to be prayerful before. And I say, please, Krishna, help me with this. Not allow my ego to get in my way, but that I really try and get this across in a very well-wishing way, as servant, nothing else, not as the master there, but as servant. And it actually works, it really helps, if we hold in like that, and we have this mood, oh please, please, Krishna, that we actually like that many situations where I thought, wow, it actually was not so bad, I managed to get this across without some ego there or something. So, but it requires introspection and awareness. Often we are not even aware of it, but we think, I mean, God, so many years I was doing the same things, or, thinking, well, I'm senior and this is right, so this gives me the right to correct, no matter how. Yeah? And sometimes people were saying to me, well, you're right, but just the way you say it, and it took me years to understand. Why? I was sometimes getting such kind of feedback. I was just not aware how subtle the ego is and how it contaminates the best idea. If it comes with an ego drive, the whole thing is spoiled, contaminated. Even in preaching, we have this a lot. That, this is when this fanaticism comes in, even though the idea might be very valuable and very right. But if the motive is not pure, purity is the force, if there's some ego there, then, in a subtle way, we want to satisfy our false ego and be right, and we don't want to satisfy only Krishna, Guru, and Prabhupada, that contaminates. And it doesn't transform people's hearts. That's the point. There's no effect on the heart. It might be impressive and all right, the first might prove this, I'm right, but no transformation on the heart. Okay. I'll finish on that note. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.